I'd like to welcome you back to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. Today's topic is animals, humans, and ethics, and our guest speaker is Dr. Michael Stingles. Okay, we're beginning the question period. Anyone who has a question needs to step up to the microphone. That is so that the TV audience can also hear them. I anticipate there'll probably be a wide variety of questions, and in out of respect to our speaker and to other people who may have questions, I'd appreciate it if you can keep your comments and your questions pretty brief and try to restrict yourself to one question. We'll have about 30 minutes for the question session. Michael, would you like to return here?
The moral concern, I mean, with suffering, I guess, has always been with us as creatures that are capable of suffering and don't like it. But it comes into moral thinking about laws and social policies with the utilitarians, sort of the beginning of modern thinking, along with economics. And the question is, if you're evaluating policies, policies are going to make some people happy and some people sad, right? Some people will benefit from them. Some people, it's going to be just the opposite. So what the utilitarians were doing, like the economists, was looking for a kind of common currency to figure out how to pick and choose between different sorts of policies. And what they fastened upon was the idea that, you know, happiness was a good thing, suffering was a bad thing, and that naturally leads to the thought that, okay, well, happiness is good, more of it's better than less. And if suffering is a bad thing, you know, the less of it, the better, right? So if you're looking around at social policies, you're looking for policies that maximize happiness and minimize suffering. So that's the way it sort of works its way into our moral thinking. At a time, I think, when societies are becoming pluralistic, right? So societies had been looking to religion as a source of moral values. And at a time when they're becoming pluralistic, the utilitarians arise and say, well, here's something that you can value, whatever your other values might be, right? Happiness. And here's something you can worry about, whatever else you might worry about, suffering. And the neat thing about happiness is the more the better. The neat thing about suffering is, you know, the less the better. So it gives us a nice, neat way of measuring social policies at a time when religion isn't giving us a kind of common moral currency anymore. The little principle I was enunciating was just equal suffering should count equally. I could try to give it some intuitive meaning, but maybe a more useful answer is to go to the answer the utilitarians themselves gave, because they were really interested in measuring. I mean, that's what you're wondering when you say, okay, here's this thing which you call suffering. What exactly is that thing? And then you talk about counting it up in ways that we can compare one individual's suffering to the suffering of another individual. So, you know, how do you make that operational? Like, how do you make that actually work in a way that not just it works, but we understand how it's working? And that was the question the utilitarians got. People wanted to know, so what's happiness? What's suffering? How do you measure in a way that you can compare and count stuff up? And the utilitarians were the economists. So they said, okay, well, preference satisfaction. We can try to see what people's preferences are, and we will make the assumption, and on their part it was an assumption, that part of happiness was having your preferences satisfied. And part of suffering or unhappiness was having your preferences go unsatisfied. So they said, whenever you're looking at a social policy, look to see what the preferences are of the people that are gonna, you know, be affected by this particular policy and try to maximize the total number of satisfied preferences, right? So identify the preferences, try to satisfy more of those preferences rather than fewer. And what they're doing in terms of doing it in terms of economics is to some extent doing it within lives. So if you're wondering, well, what would be the most reasonable thing for me to do? I could do policy one in my own life or policy two in my own life. What they were saying is, well, look at your preferences and following which policy would satisfy more of your preferences. And we could even start worrying about whether some preferences are more important than other preferences by asking what you'd trade off for what, right? So we can start establishing for people a preference ranking. And their thought was, if we can do this in economics with individual decision making, well, why don't we just do it at a grander social level and, you know, ask people what their preferences are, what preferences are more important than other preferences in terms of what they're willing to make trade-offs for in the way that we do with regard to individual rationality and economics, and count up the satisfied preferences. Now, there is assumption here, I think, that, yeah, satisfied preferences are tied up with happiness. And that's not always true, right? We all know of cases where we got what we wanted and it didn't make us happy, right? Or we got what we wanted and it caused us to suffer. So at best, what they're working with there is, I think, a kind of generalization that in general, getting what you want makes you happier and not getting what you want makes you sadder. But the two things to realize about it is it's a generalization, so it's not entirely correct, but it's correct enough to generate actual results. And that's what we've been doing since then in economics, and to some degree in social policy as well, to the extent that we're utilitarians in making our social decisions. Pardon me? The comment back was, so what you have to do is sort of unlock or open up that assumption. And that's, in fact, what the utilitarians did. Well, they opened it up or unlocked it to make it work, to make it operational, which was half of your question, I think. Like, okay, how do you make, give me a sense of counting in which counting looks like counting. And the way you do that is by talking about preferences and counting up preferences that are satisfied or unsatisfied. The other question is, how do you know that suffering's bad? So, okay, you can connect suffering to lack of satisfied preferences, and you can run around and count up those unsatisfied preferences. But how do you know that suffering's bad? And I think for people like Bentham and the other utilitarians, that is an undefended assumption. And the idea is for those of us who can experience it, it's bad. And if we think about the experience of it, it's not so bad that we're experiencing it. Right? If I ask, well, what's bad about the suffering that I'm now feeling? It's not that it's my suffering. It's that it's suffering, right? So there is this assumption that human beings, by and large, don't like suffering. And what they don't like about it is an aspect of suffering itself, right? Not the fact that it's theirs or anybody else's, but it's just a bad thing in and of itself. But that is the foundational assumption of the moral theory.
As a single, I recall years ago, reading as much as I could understand a philosopher, a British philosopher, Bertrand Russell, who indicated, as I interpreted it, that the sadness that we have as humanity is that we have advanced so far technically, but socially we are so sluggish and still in the dark ages. He thought another million years might bring some balance to it. But it would seem that the suffering and the happiness, those two constituents, are both tied up in social programs, as it were, today. But in the social advancement we have, those things are in the same category. Do you see, in your vast reading, do you see any diminishing in the great breach that exists between technology and sociology as far as it affects our human condition?
Before I answer the question, let me just say a little bit about Russell's point. There's a cartoon I saw back when I was an undergraduate in Wisconsin, and I wish I could have made a photocopy of it, but I didn't. It was a very nice cartoon. I think we've all seen these sort of evolutionary, the sort of the ages of man, right? And it's usually a man, right? So you start off with a kind of little dancing monkey at one end, right? And then the next stage in human evolution is the kind of knuckle-dragging primate, right? And then somebody's walking a little bit more upright, but with a pretty flat forehead, you know, pretty hairy. And then the last figure in the sequence is, you know, the upright, you know, modern male striding along, right? So the evolutionary development of mankind from dancing monkey to, you know, individual looks kind of like me, receding hairline but high forehead, you know, walking along with not very much hair. Well, the cartoon had the evolution of technology and the evolution of ethics. And the evolution of technology was exactly that sequence of pictures, except as the figure begins walking in an upright way, first he's got a spear, then he's got a rifle, then he's carrying a nuclear warhead in the last picture, right, showing us clearly how we've developed technologically. The evolution of morality was the dancing monkey all the way across. We got really good in terms of our firepower, but in terms of our ethics, we stayed the dancing monkey. We didn't get a lot better. And to some extent, I think that is untrue. I mean, not that we're more perhaps deeply moral than we ever were before, but to some extent, we do make moral progress. And I was chatting with somebody over lunch about species lines and race lines. And up until about 1865 in the United States, people were enslaved largely because of their race. And if you said, well, why is it okay to enslave them? You got an answer along racial lines. Well, because they're of a different race than us. But fairly quickly, even in the 19th century and before, people started to wonder about the moral relevance of race and wondered, you know, is this the right kind of category to be a moral category? And so people would have to defend slavery by saying, well, what's tied up with race, it's not just race itself, but what's tied up with race is lack of intellectual capacity. You just can't be educated to be as smart as we, the slave owners, are. So slaves are rather like little kids. You have to take care of them. You can't leave them on their own. You can't really educate them. Now, of course, what happened is some of the slaves did begin to read and run around giving lectures and giving talks, and it was pretty clear, well, they were capable of everything that the slave owners were capable of when it came to intelligence. And by and large, that led to the demise of slavery, right? The thought that, okay, we've got to treat like cases alike. You know, we thought these guys we were enslaving were different from us in a morally relevant kind of way. It turns out not. So at the beginning, there's a lot of resistance. How can people run around claiming this? And, you know, surely it's absurd. But what triumphed at the end of the day was treat like cases alike. So we got a little bit better. We had been bad. We had been enslaving people. We got a little bit better. Did we get morally perfect? Well, no. And part of what Singer's suggesting is, well, here's another case where we're drawing a kind of moral line where it looks like we shouldn't be drawing it. We're not treating like cases alike in certain important sorts of ways. And to begin with, everybody's going to throw up their arms and say, no, no, you know, this can't be going on. Species lines do count, or it matters who you're socially related to, and animals are animals, and humans are humans. But the same problem, Singer, I think, thinks will arise, that unless we can point to some clearly relevant sorts of differences in terms of how we treat human beings and how we treat animals, our current treatment of animals is going to go by the boards in the same way that slavery did. Now, are we going to let them into university and let them run for public office? Well, no, they're not that kind of equal. Well, there are a lot of primates running around that we wonder, should they be in the offices that they are? But his claim is to treat equal cases equally. And in the case of race, what that meant was one thing. In the case of most of us and animals, it means another thing. But in terms of severely impaired humans, it may mean that we're much more ready to end their lives than we currently are, right? If we think that, and that wasn't a transition I made particularly well, I think, in the talk, in terms of moving from treat equal suffering equally to, well, what about killing animals? Because what a lot of people will say in terms of killing animals is, well, we're going to treat equal suffering equally, but if animals don't suffer because they fear death, there's nothing wrong with killing them in a painless way. And Singer is quite willing to concede that, which is why he's quite willing to concede in the case of severely impaired newborns that not only would it be right to let them die, but it might be right to kill them. for the same reason it's okay to kill animals.
Terry Schillinger, Michael, thank you for being here and for you certainly put up a hard attempt at our table. I'd like to get this conversation down to a real practical level, like what I'm supposed to have for lunch. And I can understand the suffering principle and that was for me up to a point. So I'm wondering, am I supposed to have a tomato or a cheese sandwich for lunch, or can I have a tuna sandwich?
Well, the situation is complicated because of the ways in which we're growing our food and what we're doing to other parts of the world and other people. Maybe to really bring it down to brass tacks, I can talk about what I had for lunch. I encountered this argument, as I said, in the early 80s. And as a result of it, and environmental sorts of concerns and concerns about the world food situation and what it meant for other people, I decided, okay, I'm going to become a vegetarian. So I've been a vegetarian now, I think, if I count back, since 1978. So I guess I actually encountered this argument late 70s. So I stopped eating red meat and chicken. I continued eating fish. And the reason I continued eating fish was their central nervous system is built in such a way that it didn't look like they could feel pain. Right? So the problem with things like cows is they have a central nervous system like ours. They can feel pain. Didn't appear at that time anyway that fish could feel pain. Now, Singer, in his most recent book about vegetarianism, cites scientific evidence that if you give fish painkillers, you know, pretty much everybody's fished, I guess, you get the hook in their mouth and they wriggle around a lot and you take the hook out. And it doesn't seem like they mind it a lot, right?
You toss Have you asked them lately?
Well, the worrisome thing is that if you give them painkillers, they don't wriggle. Now, what that suggests is the painkillers might be doing the same thing in them that they're doing in us. That, yeah, they do feel pain. They've got whatever the neural hardware is that they need to do that. The painkillers block the pain signals, and so they're perfectly capable of feeling pain. And so, in fact, we're treating fish a lot worse than we're treating the factory-farmed animals in some respects, right? Because we're hauling them out in big nets and letting them flop around and suffocate. So now I'm evaluating whether I should have had my tuna fish sandwich. So this is a road fraught with peril, right? We have to eat, and the question is, yeah, but who suffers if we eat? And how do we minimize that suffering? It's a real question.
Going to make a comment, and then I'll sit down. I'm just observing, so I'm wrestling with this, what to have for lunch. I'm just observing a predatory universe in which many creatures are carnivores and prey on other creatures, and I see human beings as essentially carnivores in that way, and that will we then need to teach other creatures in the food chain not to be vegetarians rather than carnivores? I'm just seeing... I understand suffering, but I'm thinking something being missed here in the food chain experience.
Well, there is one thing that's better than behaving well, you know, morally yourself, and that's imposing that same moral behavior on others, right? So, yeah, if we reform our food practices, we have to bring the other animals around. Yeah, I mean, some animals can't help themselves, right? So we can't hold them responsible for what they do. And to some extent, yeah, we're biologically predators, and we need a certain amount of protein in our diets. You know, all of those things are true. We still need to think about how we're producing that protein and what it means for the animals that are involved, what it means for the planet. Right? That was another thing, I guess, that way back in the late 70s, early 80s made me wonder about processing lots and lots of grain through essentially fewer and fewer cattle, so those of us in the first world could eat the kinds of things that we're eating, right? So there's human equality issues that get tied up here. There's environmental issues that get tied up here. There's how it affects the animals themselves. Now, I'm in effect just giving you the puzzle, right? And now you're sort of wondering, yeah, but what is the puzzle meant for you and what do you think about it? Which is a fair enough question. I guess I came to the same conclusion that Singer did, which was that there was actually nothing wrong with killing animals. It was wrong to do certain sorts of things that we were doing to them in terms of factory farming, that some of the stuff we were doing mattered to them. And in fact, some of the ways in which we were killing them mattered to them. So there's a woman who I'm sure has addressed this group, Temple Grandin, an autistic woman who worries a lot about the design of slaughterhouses so that the animals aren't as distressed as they are by that kind of experience. And insofar as there are ways of designing slaughterhouses, so they really are taken unawares and undistressed, I came to the same conclusion Singer himself had come to, which was there's nothing wrong with it. And you say, well, why is there nothing wrong with it? The answer was, because they don't fear death, right? They certainly enjoy stuff while they're on the planet. They like to eat. They like to, you know, reproduce. They like to do certain sorts of things. And as long as you're producing more and more of them, more and more of them are enjoying the kinds of things they enjoy. Of course, the trade-off is that you are killing them along the way. But if that doesn't matter to them in a way that would matter to us, right? If you told me, I'm going to give you 20 years of great enjoyment, good food, good sex, you know, whatever you want, of course I'll painlessly kill you at the end of that. Right? As well, I mean, that's the Ishiguro story. That's what they don't like. And I think human beings, you know, value life, fear death. Cows don't value life and don't fear death. They like a good meal, a good bowel movement, you know, good copulation. But their lives and their deaths don't matter to them in ways that ours do. So it's okay to kill them. The flip side of that is, what about severely impaired human beings who meet exactly those same criteria? That's the bullet that Singer has bitten and said, it's okay to kill them. And that's why they didn't want to let him into Germany and they didn't want to let him into Princeton.
I forgot to mention, can you state your name at the beginning of the question? I think we have time for one or two more questions.
My name's Allison Landers, and I'd like to know particularly what studies have been done to tell us that animals don't fear death.
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure how you tell when there isn't a language capacity. One thing one looks at is things like mourning behavior, right? And elephants seem to exhibit it. Chimpanzees certainly seem to exhibit it. And the question is, does that mean that they can fear their own deaths, or that they just mourn the loss of somebody that meant a great deal to them? And maybe that's tied up with why it might be wrong to kill them, right? If they can feel that, right? If they mourn the death of others, maybe that's something to take into consideration. So one kind of question here is, how would you know when an individual is capable of this or not capable of it, especially in gray area sorts of cases? And if you don't know, what should you do? Like, what should your moral judgment be under situations of uncertainty? Or if you don't know, should you just refrain from doing something, or do it, or do it in a more careful sort of way? Very real sorts of questions. How do you tell? To some extent, we think we can tell these sorts of things. How do we tell? Right? Maybe it does matter to chimps. Maybe their own death does, in fact, matter to them greatly. Maybe it does to cows. It seems unlikely in terms of their general level of cognitive development, but how would we figure that out?
My name is Kathy Coates, and we also had a very rich discussion at the table. It was wonderful. And I might be the only other vegetarian in the room besides you. Several thoughts come to mind, and you know, I go back to the phrase, I'm paraphrasing Tolstoy when he says, one day we will reach a place in our humanity where we don't kill. End of sentence kind of thing. And we certainly talked at our table around capital punishment, and where does that, because that is making a choice to kill somebody, and we know our neighbors to the south in many states do make that very clear decision to kill somebody. But my question is around, cultural assumptions we have. You know, North America, we don't have rabbits.